This year, 2011, marks the 400th anniversary of the publication of the King James translation of the Bible. In celebration of that anniversary, we are pleased to welcome world-renowned Bible scholar David Norton to our campus. Professor Norton pursued graduate study at Cambridge University and moved thereafter to New Zealand, where he is currently professor of English at Victoria University of Wellington. His first book, entitled A History of the Bible as Literature, won the Conference on Christian Literature Book of the Year Award in 1994 for the work which has contributed most to the dialogue between literature and the Christian faith. At the request of Cambridge University Press, Professor Norton then edited the text of the King James Bible, conforming it to the original translator's decisions, and modernizing the spelling, punctuation, and presentation. This labor of love required that Professor Norton scrutinize every word and every punctuation mark in the entire Bible against the earliest printings and the remaining primary sources from the original translation effort. Cambridge's landmark King James Version edition of 2005, edited by Professor Norton, incorporates the findings of his exhaustive study. It is a masterpiece. The 2005 edition and his textual history of the King James Bible were published together as the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible in 2005. David Norton is a fellow of the Royal Society of New Zealand and of the New Zealand Academy of the Humanities. His latest book is entitled The King James Bible, A Short History from Tyndale to Today. Professor Norton may know the King James Bible better than anyone else on earth. We are pleased to have him on campus and to hear from him today. Would you please join me in welcoming Professor David Norton to Brigham Young University?
I probably know the semicolons better than anybody else, but really knowing the King James well, that's a different matter, so I'd worry about that. Now, the background to the slide I'm showing you is the view from my office window, just to give you a sense of where I come from in New Zealand, and I'm pleased to come to another university that has wonderful views out of its office windows. My title is The English Word, and that, of course, alludes to John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, if this were a sermon, that would be my text. This year, we're celebrating the quattrocentenary of the King James Bible, so I want to start with a quick look at the newborn child, and I particularly, by the way, have newborn children in mind today because my first granddaughter was born today. And I also, thank you. I also have on a New Zealand tie with a koru design on it, and the koru represents new birth. It's based on the unfolding of a fern. Anyway, let's look at the newborn child that we are concerned with in the context of its immediate ancestor, the 1602 edition of the Bishop's Bible. The Bishop's Bible has this title page. At the top, you can see God, represented by the Tetragrammaton. Below is Jesus as the Lamb. Then you have the dove of the Holy Spirit. And at the corners of the title panel are large images of the evangelists. On the left are the 12 tribes of Israel, and on the right, the 12 disciples. Now, this title page became the title page for the first edition of the King James Bible New Testament. Not the whole Bible, but the New Testament. And then it became the title page for most of the folio editions of the King James Bible through to 1640. This bespeaks continuity. There is a like father, like son aspect here. But the main title page of the first edition of the King James shows continuity and newness. It's the most striking of the early title pages. We've got all the basic elements of the 1602 title page incorporated. Beneath God is the dove, then the image of the lamb, held by Peter and Paul. So the order of the Trinity has been changed so that the relationship between these founders of the church and Jesus can be emphasized visually. The evangelists are still there. They're in the corners of the image. The 12 tribes are moved to the frieze, two-thirds of the way up the title page. And the disciples are represented by lifelike figures above the frieze. What this does is to beautifully represent the living word of the New Testament built upon the foundation of the Old Testament. We find two figures added, Moses on the left and Aaron on the right, with Aaron's presence emphasizing the importance of the priesthood. I take this engraving as representing not just the structure of the Bible and the God-given nature of Anglican Christianity, but also the finely revised newness of the King James Bible, at once traditional and new. If we compare the titles, then again tradition and newness are apparent. The main title and the statement about the printer remain the same, but in the middle of the King James title, the newness is stated. We're told newly translated and so on. So the King James announced itself as both a new translation from the Hebrew and Greek and a revision of the preceding English Bibles. Now, interestingly, the King James is not authorized and appointed as that 1602 Bible was, but it's simply appointed to be read in churches. I think that the word authorized may not have had the resonance that we now give it. It was only rarely used in earlier Bibles, and then I think more or less as a synonym for appointed. And the point here was that the King James could be used to fulfill the injunctions there were that churches should have a large Bible. Now, it's worth noting that this new Bible is not called the King James Bible or the King James Version or the Authorized Version. Almost all our names for the early English Bibles are nicknames because they all had roughly the same title, the Bible. Now, I like to call it the King James Bible because this, with variations such as the Royal Bible, has the longest history. Moreover, there's justice in the title's reference to King James, where it says, by His Majesty's special commandment. Without him, this version would not have been made, nor would it have been so well made. The grand scheme for the making of the King James, which involved about 50 translators from all sides of the church, working in a succession of orderly stages, reflected James's ambitions and also his experience only 2 years before of a failed attempt to make an official new version in Scotland. In other words, he was an experienced academic administrator by this time and knew how to get people working together. We'll also find on the title page flattery of James. Like God, He gave the commandment to make this Bible, not the command, as you find on most King James title pages from 1629 onwards. Finally, there's the date, 1611. We don't know exactly when the King James was first published, because as a revision of an existing book, it did not have to be registered. It could have been published any time between March 1611 and February 1612, because old-style dates were in use then and the calendar year finished with February. So if we want, we can extend the celebratory year through to the end of February next year. Do I get a return invitation? Thank you. The first edition had 75 pages of preliminary material, including a calendar, which I show you here. And by the way, I picked these two pages from the calendar, 1602, 1611, because 1611's got a mistake on it. It has the daylight hours reversed for July. And, you know, editors like places where these kind of things happen. There are tables of lessons. There are also similar material appearing in prayer books at the same time, and the Bishop's Bible. My point here is continuity. We have here a very strong visual sign of the King James's connection with its official predecessor. Also, like the Bishop's Bible, but visually far more elaborate, there was a genealogy from Adam and Eve to Christ. This time you see the careful newness of the King James imaged to you. Now, the most important part of the preliminary material is the preface, the translators to the reader, written by Bishop Miles Smith, he became a bishop later, on behalf of the translators. It begins with a wise, prophetic defense of revision, asking, was there ever anything projected that savored any way of newness or renewing, but the same endured many a storm of gainsaying or opposition? It praises the scriptures with considerable eloquence. It shows the necessity of translating even into what it calls the vulgar tongue. In other words, common language. Here he's particularly got in mind Roman Catholic arguments against vernacular translation. He defends the work of the English predecessors of the King James translators, saying that they deserve to be had of us and of posterity in everlasting remembrance. He adds that the very meanest translation of the Bible in English set forth by men of our profession, that's men of our belief, containeth the word of God, nay, is the word of God. Interpreted by every, though it be not interpreted by every translator with the like grace, nor peradventure so fitly for phrase, nor so expressly for sense everywhere. An important statement that, well worth thinking about. Turning to their own work, Smith discusses some aspects of how they translated, such as their refusal to tie themselves to a uniformity of phrasing or to an identity of words. But it's his first point, I think, that's most important here, his description of the purpose of the translators. Truly, good Christian reader, we never thought from the beginning that we should need to make a new translation, nor yet to make of a bad one a good one, but to make a good one better, or out of many good ones, one principal good one, not justly to be accepted against. That hath been our endeavour, that our mark. To that purpose, there were many chosen that were greater in other men's eyes than in their own, and that sought the truth rather than their own praise. In short, they were trying to get the truth, the precise meaning of the originals, into English in as faithful a manner as possible, and in a way that would be as little controversial as possible. They worked in a scholarly and faithful spirit. Smith emphasizes the faithfulness over the scholarly, asking how they gathered together for the work, in the trust of their own knowledge or of their sharpness of wit or deepness of judgment, as it were, in an arm of flesh. At no hand, they trusted in him that hath the key of David, opening and no man shutting. They prayed to the Lord, the Father of our Lord, to the effect that St. Augustine did, O let thy scriptures be my pure delight, Let me not be deceived in them, neither let me deceive by them. As the long history of the King James attests, the history of its acceptance, they succeeded. If we move on now and turn to the pages of the text, let's imagine a priest opening his new church Bible for the first time. Here's the beginning of John's Gospel in the new Bible, set beside the Bishop's Bible of 1602. Our priest would have found it reassuringly familiar. The general layout is identical, and in this case, even the decorative initial at the beginning of the chapter is the same. Probably the only differences he would have been aware of were the larger type and the emptier margins. James, apparently for his own reasons, but in hindsight I think very wisely, had insisted that there be no doctrinal annotations in this Bible. His particular objection had been to the annotations in the Geneva Bible, which approved disobedience to kings in certain circumstances. Obviously, he wouldn't like that. But the point about the absence of annotations is that it made the King James a largely neutral text from a doctrinal point of view, so capable of being used without dissent by all Protestants. But what would have been our priest's reaction when he started to read and found that the first two verses read differently from the bishop's Bible? It had given them this way: in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and God was that Word. God was that Word. The same was in the beginning with God. Now, I doubt if he would have been as shocked as you would be if you opened a new copy of the King James and found what I've just quoted instead of what you knew was the right reading. He wouldn't have been so shocked because more than likely he read the Geneva Bible, the most popular Bible of the time, outside the pulpit, and the Geneva Bible was constantly different from the Bishop's Bible. Even here, its text is slightly different from the Bishop's Bible and from the King James. He probably also read Latin versions, for he would have been educated in Latin, and he probably would have been able to read Greek. In short, our priest would have been used to reading multiple versions, and he probably regarded the English translations in the same way as the translators did, as an approximation to the originals. It's worth remembering, by the way, that our habit of quoting the English Bible exactly only became ingrained in the 18th century, and it's a marker of how much we begin to think of the King James as being exactly the text of the Bible rather than an approximation. Right, here we must leave the first edition, because what we're celebrating is not a particular edition, but the words and spirit found in that edition. Birth, here embodied in the first edition, follows gestation and is succeeded by growth. So I want now to offer you some observations about the gestation of the King James. And first of all, to state what should be obvious but is nearly always forgotten, it began with the telling and writing of the books that became the Hebrew and Greek scriptures. In the first place, the King James is good because they were good. The actual writing of the King James began with William Tyndale translating the New Testament and publishing his first complete edition in 1526. Now, I think of the creation of the King James as a long process of drafting and revision that was completed by the King James translators. Instead of a single author making a succession of drafts, what we have here is multiple authors, all engaged in the same grand enterprise and all driven by the same spirit, the desire to bring the truth of the scriptures as accurately and comprehensively as possible to the people in their own language. This is what Miles Smith was referring to when he wrote of making out of many good versions one principal good one. Let me show you the first draft of the King James Bible, again showing the beginning of the King James of John's Gospel. It's Tyndale's 1526 translation, reproduced from the copy that the British Library paid £1 million for. But for that word, twice in the first verse, Tyndale has written the Bishop's Bible version. Now, Tyndale's archenemy, Sir Thomas More, or Saint if you prefer to call him, but that's a Roman Catholic point of view, remarked, "Though I cannot make Tyndale by no means write true matter, I would have him yet, at the least, write true English." He suggested that Tyndale too often followed the word order of the originals to the detriment of both sense and English style, and More proposed an alternative translation of John 1:1, which Tyndale adopted for his revised New Testament of 1534. See what you think of it. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God." It's the version you know. In short, Thomas More, correcting Tyndale, created the King James's John 1:1, and Tyndale, following More's criticisms, created the second verse. This gives us a tiny sense of how the King James was written. It's enough to say that the main versions from Tyndale onwards, Coverdale, Great Bible, Geneva Bible, Bishop's Bible, and the Roman Catholic Reims New Testament, all contributed words, phrases, and understanding, and that occasionally we can trace readings also to other sources like Thomas More. If we analyse the English sources for readings found in the King James, it will appear that Tyndale supplied more than any other, that's in the parts where he translated, followed next by Coverdale, and that the King James translators often supplied little that was new. Now, this gives the impression that the King James translators did little. It's a reasonable inference, but it's wrong. The King James translators examined every word of the text, and even a decision not to make changes in the text can have just as much work behind it as the decision to make a change. Moreover, the King James translators made many more changes than this kind of simple analysis of sources shows. They were instructed to follow the church's official version, the Bishop's Bible, and they used the 1602 edition. They were instructed to alter it as little as the truth of the original will permit. So they based it on the 1602 edition, which was itself a revision of the original 1568 edition of the Bishop's Bible. One only has to look at the copy of the 1602 edition that contains their nearly final manuscript work to see that they did a huge amount. The slide, by the way, that I've given you is from Hosea. You'll see it covered in annotations, and I give you that because it's got an interesting reading on it and because we don't have their work on John 1:1. I want now to move on to give you a glimpse of the mental world and scholarship, in other words, the human abilities with which the translators did their faithful work. It's quite common to think of this mental world in Jacobean and in literary terms, as Gustavus S. Paine did when he wrote that the great poetry of the age was all around the scholars as they worked on the Bible, was in their thought and feeling and quickened the flow of their language. Now we get a totally different mental world visible in the work of the translator whose proposal at the Hampton Court Conference that led to the King James, John Reynolds. Here's part of the title page of one of his works, The Overthrow of Stage Plays, wherein is manifestly proved that it is not only unlawful to be an actor, but a beholder of those vanities. That's not a spirit that would be sympathetic to Shakespeare, would even have heard of Shakespeare, is it? Now, the book itself is based on the Bible. It's based on church fathers, it's based on the classics, and it shows no sign at all of first-hand knowledge of contemporary theatre. Now, Reynolds was a leading Puritan, but the mental world this suggests, steeped in scholarship and ignorant of contemporary vernacular literature, is, I think, generally right for the translators. William Branthwaite's library gives us a similar picture. It's got about 1,400 books in it, and only one work of English literature in it, The Spider and the Fly, which I suspect not more than a single person here would have heard of. Continental religious works in Latin dominate. There's an extensive, approaching exhaustive collection of church fathers, mostly in Latin, sometimes Greek. There's also an extensive collection of commentaries. They're medieval, they're Roman Catholic, they're Protestant. Literature is represented by Greek and Latin classics. You get a similar picture out of the diary kept by John Boys in his later years. It doesn't show any awareness of English literature. It's a fragment of what must be a much longer diary. It begins with him in the middle of reading St. Augustine. This reading continued for 13 months. You see on the right-hand side of the slide, by the way, one page from his notes on St. Augustine. That's his authentic handwriting for when he's writing in Latin, and these are student study notes, though the student happens to be about 70 years old. Later on, he spent the best part of a year reading perhaps the most extraordinary of the near 60 grammars, Latin, Greek, Hebrew, Syriac, that he'd read. I quote from his biographer there, the French scholar Boudaeus's 968-page commentary on the Greek language, written 1529. In other words, this translator was at home in the past, he was at home in scholarship. The mental world of the translators, I suggest to you, was dominated by theology, both Protestant and Roman Catholic, by scholarship and by the classics. Most, perhaps all of them, would have been astonished to discover that they lived in a great age of English literature. Primarily, they thought and wrote in Latin, a language Miles Smith describes them as having been exercised in almost from our very cradle. Another of the translators, John Overall, complained that he'd spoken Latin so long it was troublesome to him to speak English in a continued oration. Now, it was this world that equipped them, for better or for worse, to revise the preceding English translations and make the King James. And I make this point, first of all, in relation to the translator's scholarship, but it also relates to their ability to write English. Fred C. Robinson noted that some of the best writers of English came to English as a second language. He was thinking of Conrad and Nabokov. But then he suggested that many of the great Renaissance English writers came to English as a second language in the sense that they studied and learned extensively in Latin, and only after forming their major intellectual concepts in that tongue turned to English as an expressive medium. All these writers had a detached perspective on English, which I believe sharpened their sense of the language as a means of communicating ideas with grace and force. This isn't to say that the translators from Tyndale to the King James translators wrote Latinate English, but to say that their mental world and their lifelong study of languages helped them communicate the grace and force of the original scriptures with comparable grace and force and with precision. I suggest that with respect to their Greek and Latin scholarship, both of the languages and of what was written in them, the King James translators were as well or better equipped than modern scholars, except, of course, in matters such as knowledge of biblical manuscripts. Now, I've just indicated the range and nature of Boyce's scholarship. He wrote this of himself. I find it quite an inspiring little passage. "Never do I use my talents better than when I devote myself to the study of letters. Indeed, I can do a little in letters. Outside letters, what am I but the lowest of all animals? Go where the genius summons you." Now, I've left genius untranslated from the Latin. It might mean talent, but I think attendant spirit is probably the best sense. This spirit informed the translator's work. It's one form, I think, of the larger spirit behind the King James. Let me give you a single example of John Boyce immersed in his own mental world. This is a characteristic page from his copy of Budaeus, and I realize you can't see it clearly, but what you can see is the intensity of the annotations, just how much there is in the margins, how almost everything is underlined. He attends to every word, he gives in full every reference, he even adds page and line numbers, he makes corrections and additions, including a possible alternative Greek reading. It's the work of an obsessive philologist. But one thing makes this page of special interest in relation to the King James. The Greek word that he has written at the top of the page, symbibazo, it's one of several verbs discussed on the page. In all likely, he wrote it there because the translators discussed the meaning of this verb as it's used in Colossians 2:2. As Boyce noted in his manuscript record of the work of the translators, they considered whether to add the words "and instructed" to the Bishop's Bible's words "knit together in love." He was saying the word... I'm finding my notes difficult just for a moment. He's saying the word symbibazo meant probably both those things, both at once, join together and instruct or teach. And the translators thought it was not inconsistent with the truth, therefore, that the apostle took account of both meanings. The question was whether there was a deliberate play on the verb's meaning. Now, Boyce remembered this discussion when in 1634, this is nearly a quarter of a century later, he saw in Budaeus a similar discussion of the meaning. So now in his 70s, we see that his interest in languages and his memory for details were as sharp as ever. That's the kind of scholarship that the translators brought to their work on the text. It tells us about their mental world. Also, it tells us in passing about the amount of work that could lie behind a decision to make no change to their predecessor. There are changes elsewhere in this verse from Colossians, but being knit together in love remains the same. I think the reason is that the translators couldn't find an English word that suggested both the meanings they saw in the Greek, and they were loath to use two verbs, as this would have suggested that the Greek had two verbs. And they probably felt they couldn't put "or" and "instructed" in the margin, because that would have suggested it was either one meaning or the other. But it was both meanings. Anyway, let's move on from these details to some generalizations. Let's itemize some of the key historical elements that led to the creation of the King James. The writing of the Old and New Testaments and the Apocrypha in the original languages. That's the first and most important thing. Secondly, the accumulated centuries of wisdom and insight into the Bible, both Christian and Jewish. Third, Reformation work to create a translation true to the originals in the language of the people. Then moving on from that, we can characterize the way the English translators worked. Except for Coverdale and the Roman Catholic translators, they used the Greek and the Hebrew as their basic texts. They were as literal as reasonably possible, aiming at scholarly fidelity to the truth of the originals. They based their language on Tyndale's. After Tyndale, they borrowed freely from each other, including borrowing from their enemies. And we can say this about the King James itself. It was the culmination of over 80 years of English translation. Its language belongs to those 80 years and is based on Tyndale's English. Because it was primarily a literal translation, its language is also a kind of Hebraic English, just as the language of the Greek New Testament is a kind of Hebraic or Aramaic Greek, as well as being everyday Greek. It was the most thorough and methodical English Reformation translation, and it was made by the best scholars of its time. Now, the best books are much more than a physical object, no matter how much has gone into them. So 1611, the year, marks, after nearly a century of development, a key moment in the history of the King James, but it continued to grow. In 1611, it wasn't what it became. Central to this growth is how it lived in the souls, the consciousnesses, and even the unconsciousnesses of those who read and heard it. Nobody in 1611 hailed it as a definitive translation. Nobody hailed it as a masterpiece of the English language. People took their time to start using it. Even the man who played a vital role in ensuring its publishing success, Archbishop William Laud, went on using the Geneva Bible for his sermon text until 1629, 18 years after the King James came out. For nearly 50 years, there were attempts, both official and unofficial, to revise it, or perhaps to have the Geneva Bible adopted in its place. The last of these was by a parliamentary subcommittee in 1656, and there the most learned men in the Oriental tongues made divers learned observations of some mistakes in the translations of the Bible in English, which yet was agreed to be the best of any translation in the world. So the view expressed in 1659 that the King James is so exact that it needs no essay towards the amendment of it prevailed. There's an important corollary, by the way, to these failed attempts at revision, and it goes along with the moves led by Archbishop Laud to suppress the printing of the Geneva Bible. After 1644, anyone, whether in England, Scotland, Ireland, or America, not yet the United States of America, anyone who wanted to buy an English Bible had only one choice: the King James Bible. It became the only Bible in the English-speaking world. Even for most Catholics, this was true. So it had a unique position for entire generations from about 1660 onwards. As the Book of Truth, it was heard and read from earliest years to the grave. It provided a single standard of both truth and language. Attitudes to its language took longer to change than judgments of its scholarship. Thomas More, to go back to him, mocked some of the shortcomings of Tyndale's vocabulary and suggested that all England list ought now to go to school with Tyndale to learn English. That's exactly what happened. Tyndale's language, as embodied and developed in the King James, not only created what has become our religious language, but it also shaped the English language. Initially, people found the language of the Bible both difficult and unnatural. So the first dictionary of the English language, published in 1604, of which this is the title page, was an aid to the understanding of hard, usual English words. Usual words, not unusual as is occasionally printed, but usual. These usual words which people were hearing or reading in scriptures, sermons, or elsewhere. The words of biblical English had become familiar, but they were difficult to understand. So there was unnaturalness in this English, and it came from ways in which it was predominantly a literal translation, bringing Hebraic expressions into English. Decades after the King James was published, John Selden commented on this literalism and the popular reaction to it. There is no book so translated as the Bible. If I translate a French book into English, I turn it into English phrase, not into French English. Il fait froid. I say, 'tis cold, not it makes cold. But the Bible is translated into English words rather than into English phrase. The Hebraisms are kept and the phrase of that language is kept, which is well enough as long as scholars have to do with it. But when it comes among the common people, Lord, what jeer do they make of it? We can get a sense, just very quickly, of how English was changing through the power of the King James from lists that there are of obsolete words and expressions compiled in the middle of the 18th century. A significant number of the words that we find on these lists are now familiar English. Just to take one of them, unwittingly, the Oxford English Dictionary observes that it was in very frequent use from about 1380 to 1630, and then from about 1815. In other words, it died out of use. But it remained there present in the Bible, and its continuous use in the Bible led to its rebirth. I think of the Bible through the 18th century as being a kind of Noah's Ark for vocabulary. And it saved a lot of words, such as ponder, warfare, heritage, laden, avenge. In some ways, I suggest, the English of the King James seemed more archaic to 18th century readers than it does to us. This is very small evidence for a large point. But what I suggest is this, that if it hadn't been for the King James, the English language would have developed differently after the Augustan period. The polished Latinism of that period of English literature was the last kind of English to develop without the influence of the King James Bible. Right, I'll try and wrap this up now. What this brief sketch of the creation and growth of the King James shows is that it grew out of a remarkably faithful scholarly translation effort, that it was gradually accepted by scholars as the best translation, and that over a century and a half, it came to be the word in English. For English Protestants, it became their representation of the word that was in the beginning. It defined what was in the Bible. It defined biblical and religious language. Indeed, for many, it was the word that was in the beginning. For some, and I think many of you are among those some, that is what it still is, the only true Bible. Now, whether or not that's your belief, the King James remains the centerpiece of the Protestant English heritage in ways I've suggested and other ways. It deserves to be read because it's a great translation that is especially sensitive to the meaning and expression of the originals. It deserves to be read both because of and in spite of its language. I say in spite of because its language isn't always easy, and because through the ways English has changed, it can be easy to misread its words, thinking that they've got familiar modern meanings where the real meaning is different. I also say it because the language is obviously not everyday modern English, and we should remember that Tyndale translated because I had perceived by experience that it was impossible to establish the lay people in any truth except the scripture were plainly laid before their eyes in their mother tongue. But I also say we should read the King James because of its language, This isn't just because we can feel in it what the King James, using words from Miles Coverdale, calls the beauty of holiness. It's also because of the need to search the scriptures. Here the King James is using a phrase from Tyndale. To search is to work and study. A good translation in language that's both familiar and challenging is a spur to this. The 6th century church father Gregory the Great memorably observed that even in the scriptures there are parts where the elephant must swim as well as others where the lamb may ford. He had in mind the mixture of simplicity and difficulty in what the scripture says, and this should never be forgotten in reading the Bible. Some of it speaks directly to the soul and heart. Some speaks with a complexity and even obscurity that has exercised commentators for thousands of years. So the reader may sometimes find the difficulties of the King James's language unnecessary, but it's well to be reminded that what is being read requires earnest engagement, and better still to have a version that so richly rewards this engagement. Thank you.